Chapter 5. We spent two evenings making our way to the pink and supple sands of the great sea. It was on the morning of the third day that we arrived at the beach, having successfully avoided a small party the sundown before. We were loath to step out into the open until we had located the precise spot, Faela Bayanin, the stairway to Rebma, and could cross quickly to it. The rising sun cast billions of bright shards into the foaming swell of the waters, and our eyes were dazzled by their dance so that we could not see beneath the surface. We had lived on fruit and water for 2 days, and I was ravenously hungry, but I forgot this as I regarded the wide, sloping tiger beach with its sudden twists and rises of coral, orange, pink, and red, and its abrupt caches of shells, driftwood, and small polished stones, and the sea beyond, rising and falling, splashing softly, all gold and blue and royal purple, and casting forth its life-song breezes like benedictions beneath dawn's violet skies. The mountain that faces the dawn, Kovir, which has held amber like a mother her child for all of time, stood perhaps 20 miles to our left. The north and the sun covered her with gold and made rainbow the veil above the city. Random looked upon it and gnashed his teeth and looked away. Maybe I did too. Deirdre touched my hand, gestured with her head, and began to walk toward the north, parallel to the shore. Random and I followed. She had apparently spotted some landmark. We'd advanced perhaps a quarter of a mile when it seemed that the earth shook lightly.
Cross beads.
Look.
Her head was tilted back and she was pointing upward. My eyes followed the gesture. Overhead a hawk circled. How much farther is it?
That cairn of stones.
I saw it perhaps 100 yards away, about 8 feet in height, builded of head-sized gray stones worn by the wind, the sand, the water, standing in the shape of a truncated pyramid. The hoofbeats came louder, and then there were the notes of a horn, not Julian's call, though.
Run!
And we did. After perhaps 25 paces, the hawk descended. It swooped at Random, but he had his blade out and took a cut at it. Then it turned its attention to Deirdre. I snatched my own blade from its sheath and tried a cut. Feathers flew. It rose and dropped again. And this time my blade bit something hard and I think it fell. But I couldn't tell for sure because I wasn't about to stop and look back. The sound of roof beats was quite steady now, and loud, and the horn notes were near at hand. We reached the cairn, and Deirdre turned at right angles to it, and headed straight toward the sea. I was not about to argue with someone who seemed to know what she was doing. I followed, and from the corner of my eye I saw the horsemen. They were still off in the distance, but they were thundering along the beach, dogs barking and horns blowing, and Random and I ran like hell, and waded out into the surf after our sister. We were up to our waists when Random said,
"It's death if I stay, and death if I go on.
One is imminent, and the other may be open to negotiation. Let's move." We did. We were on some sort of rocky surface which descended into the sea. I didn't know how we would breathe while we walked it, but Deirdre didn't seem worried about it, so I tried not to be. But I was. When the water swirled and swished about our heads, I was very worried. Deirdre walked straight ahead, though, descending, and I followed, and Random followed. Each few feet there was a drop. We were descending an enormous staircase, and it was named Faela Bayanin, I knew. One more step would bring the water above my head, but Deirdre had already dropped below the waterline. So I drew a deep breath and took the plunge. There were more steps, and I kept following them. I wondered why my body was not naturally buoyed above them, for I continued to remain erect, and each step bore me downward as though on a natural staircase, though my movements were somewhat slowed. I began wondering what I'd do when I could hold my breath no longer. There were bubbles about Random's head and Deirdre's. I tried to observe what they were doing, but I couldn't figure it. Their breaths seemed to be rising and falling in a normal manner. When we were about 10 feet beneath the surface, Random glanced at me from where he moved at my left side, and I heard his voice. It was as though I had my ear pressed against the bottom of a bathtub, and each of his words came as the sound of someone kicking upon the side. They were clear, though.
"I don't think you'll persuade the dogs to follow, even if the horses do."
"How are you managing to breathe?" I tried saying, and I heard my own words distantly.
"Relax. If you're holding your breath, let it out and don't worry. You'll be able to breathe so long as you don't venture off the stairway."
"How can that be?"
"If we make it, you'll know."
His voice had a ringing quality to it, through the cold and passing green. We were about 20 feet beneath the surface by then, and I exhaled a small amount of air and tried inhaling for perhaps a second. There was nothing disturbing about the sensation, so I protracted it. There were more bubbles, but beyond that I felt nothing uncomfortable in the transition. There was no sense of increasing pressure during the next 10 feet or so, and I could see the staircase on which we moved, as though through a greenish fog. Down, down, down it led, straight, direct. And there was some kind of light coming from below us.
If we can make it through the archway, we'll be safe.
You'll be safe.
I wondered what he had done to be despised in the place called Rebma.
If they ride horses which have never made the journey before, then they'll have to follow on foot. In that case, we'll make it.
So they might not follow, if that is the case.
We hurried. By the time we were perhaps 50 feet below the surface, the waters grew quite dark and chill. But the glow before us and below us increased, and after another 10 steps I could make out the source. There was a pillar rising to the right. At its top was something globe-like and glowing. Perhaps 15 steps lower, another such formation occurred to the left. Beyond that, it seemed there was another one on the right, and so on. When we entered the vicinity of the thing, the waters grew warmer and the stairway itself became clear. It was white, shot through with pink and green, and resembled marble, but was not slippery despite the water. It was perhaps 50 feet in width, and there was a wide banister of the same substance on either side. Fishes swam past us as we walked it. When I looked back over my shoulder, there seemed to be no sign of pursuit. It became brighter. We entered the vicinity of the first light, and it wasn't a globe on the top of a pillar. My mind must have added that touch to the phenomenon to try to rationalize it at least a bit. It appeared to be a flame, about 2 feet in height, dancing there as atop a huge torch. I decided to ask about it later and saved my, if you'll excuse the expression, breath, for the rapid descent we were making. After we had entered the alley of light and had passed 6 more of the torches, Random said,
"They're after us."
I looked back again and saw distant figures descending, 4 of them on horseback. It is a strange feeling to laugh underwater and hear yourself. Let them. I touched the hilt of my blade. For now, we have made it this far. I feel a power upon me. We hurried, though, and off to our left and to our right the water grew black as ink. Only the stairway was illuminated in our mad flight down it, and distantly I saw what appeared to be a mighty arch. Deirdre was leaping down the stairs 2 at a time, and there came a vibration now from the staccato beat of the horse's hooves behind us. The band of armed men filling the way from banister to banister was far behind and above. But the 4 horsemen had gained on us. We followed Deirdre as she rushed downward, and my hand stayed upon my blade. 3, 4, 5. We passed that many lights before I looked back again and saw that the horsemen were perhaps 50 feet above us. The footmen were now almost out of sight. The archway loomed ahead, perhaps 200 feet distant. Big, shining like alabaster and carved with tritons, sea nymphs, mermaids, and dolphins, it was. And there seemed to be people on the other side of it.
They must wonder why we have come there.
It will be an academic point if we don't make it. Hurrying as another glance revealed that the horsemen had gained 10 feet on us, I drew my blade then, and it flashed in the torchlight. Random followed suit. After another 20 steps or so, the vibrations were terrible within the green, and we turned, so as not to be cut down as we ran. They were almost upon us. The gates lay 100 feet to our back, and it might have been 100 miles unless we could take the 4 horsemen. I crouched, as the man who was headed toward me swung his blade. There was another rider to his right and slightly to his rear, so naturally I moved to his left, near to the rail. This required that he strike cross-body, as he held his blade in his right hand. When he struck, I parried in court and riposted. He was leaning far forward in the saddle, and the point of my blade entered his neck on the right side. A great billow of blood like crimson smoke arose and swirled within the greenish light. Crazily, I wished Van Gogh were there to see it. The horse continued past, and I leaped at the second rider from the rear. He turned to parry the stroke, succeeded, but the force of his speed through the water and the strength of my blow removed him from the saddle. As he fell, I kicked, and he drifted. I struck at him, hovering there above me, and he parried again, but this carried him beyond the rail. I heard him scream as the pressure of the waters came upon him. Then he was silent. I turned my attention then to Random, who had slain both the horse and the man, and was dueling with a second man on foot. By the time I reached them, he had slain the man and was laughing. The blood billowed above them, and I suddenly realized that I had known mad, sad, bad Vincent van Gogh, and it was really too bad that he couldn't have painted this. The footmen were perhaps 100 feet behind us, and we turned and headed toward the arches. Deirdre had already passed through them. We ran, and we made it. There were many swords at our sides, and the footmen turned back. Then we sheathed our blades.
I've had it.
We moved to join with the band of people who had stood to defend us. Random is immediately ordered to surrender his blade, and he shrugged and handed it over. Then two men came and stood on either side of him and a third at his back, and we continued on down the stair. I lost all sense of time in that watery place, but I feel that we walked for somewhere between a quarter of an hour and half an hour before we reached our destination. The golden gates of Reba stood before us. We passed through them. We entered the city. Everything was to be seen through a green haze. There were buildings, all of them fragile and most of them high, grouped in patterns and standing in colors that entered my eyes and tore through my mind, seeking after remembrance. They failed, the sole result of their digging being the now familiar ache that accompanies the half-recalled, the unrecalled. I had walked these streets before, however, that I knew were ones very much like them. Random had not said a single word since he had been taken into custody. Deirdre's only conversation had been to inquire after our sister Luella. She had been informed that Luella was in Reba. I examined our escort. They were men with green hair, purple hair, and black hair, and all of them had eyes of green, save for one fellow whose were of a hazel color. All wore only scaled trunks and cloaks, cross braces on their breasts, and short swords depending from seashell belts. All were pretty much lacking in body hair. None of them spoke to me, though some stared and some glared. I was allowed to keep my weapon. Inside the city, we were conducted up a wide avenue, lighted by pillar flames set at even closer intervals than on Faella Bionin, and people stared out at us from behind octagonal, tinted windows, and bright-bellied fishes swam by. There came a cool current, like a breeze, as we turned a corner, and after a few steps, a warm one, like a wind, we were taken to the palace in the center of the city, and I knew it as my hand knew the glove in my belt. It was an image of the Palace of Amber, obscured only by the green and confused by the many strangely placed mirrors which had been set within its walls, inside and out. A woman sat upon the throne in the glassite room I almost recalled, and her hair was green though streaked with silver, and her eyes were round as moons of jade, and her brows rose like the wings of olive gulls. Her mouth was small, her chin was small, her cheeks were high and wide and rounded. A circlet of white gold crossed her brow, and there was a crystal necklace about her neck. At its tip there flashed a sapphire between her sweet bare breasts, whose nipples were also a pale green. She wore scaled trunks of blue and a silver belt, and she held a scepter of pink coral in her right hand, and had a ring upon every finger, and each ring had a stone of a different blue within it. She did not smile as she spoke.
What seek you here, outcasts of Amber?
Her voice was a lisping, soft, flowing thing.
We flee the wrath of the prince who sits in the true city, Eric. To be frank, we wish to work his downfall. If he is loved here, we are lost, and we have delivered ourselves into the hands of our enemies. But I feel he is not loved here, so we come asking aid. Gentle Moir.
I will not give you troops to assault Amber. As you know, the chaos would be reflected within my own realm.
That is not what we would have of you, dear Moir, but only a small thing, to be achieved with no pain or cost to yourself or your subjects.
Name it, for as you know, Eric is almost as disliked here as this recreant who stands at your left hand.
With this she gestured at my brother, who stared at her in frank and insolent appraisal, a small smile playing about the corners of his lips. If he was going to pay whatever the price for whatever he had done, I could see that he would pay it like a true prince of Amber, as our three dead brothers had done ages ago. I suddenly recalled. He would pay it, mocking them the while, laughing though his mouth was filled with the blood of his body, and as he died he would pronounce an irrevocable curse which would come to pass. I, too, had this power, I suddenly knew, and I would use it if circumstances required its use.
The thing I would ask is for my brother Corwin, who is also brother to the Lady Luella, who dwells here with you. I believe that he has never given you offense.
That is true, but why does he not speak for himself?
That is a part of the problem, lady. He cannot, for he does, not know what to ask. Much of his memory is departed from an accident which occurred when he dwelled among shadows. It is to restore his remembrance that we have come here, to bring back his recollection of the old days, that he might oppose Eric and Amber.
Continue.
Moira regarding me through the shadows of her lashes on her eyes.
In Aranoff Lace, in this building, there is a room where few would go. In that room, upon the floor, traced in fiery outline, there lies a duplicate of the thing we call the pattern. Only a son or daughter of Amber's late liege may walk this pattern and live, and it gives to such a person a power over shadow.
Here Moir blinked several times, and I speculated as to the number of her subjects she had sent upon that path, to gain some control of this power for Rebma. Of course, she had 5 AD.
To walk the pattern, should we feel, restore to Corwin his memory of himself as a prince of Amber. He cannot go to Amber to do it, and this is the only place I know where it is duplicated, other than Tir na n'Okan, where of course we may not go at this time.
Moir turned her gaze upon my sister, swept it over random, returned it to me.
Is Corwin willing to essay this thing?
I bowed. Willing, m'lady. She smiled then.
Very well. You have my permission. I can guarantee you no guarantees of safety beyond my realm, however.
As to that, your majesty, we expect no boons, but will take care of it ourselves upon our departure.
Save for Random, who will be quite safe.
What mean you?
Random would not, of course, speak for himself under the circumstances.
Surely you recall that one time Prince Random came into my realm as a friend, and did thereafter depart in haste with my daughter Morganthy.
I have heard this said, Lady Moir, but I am not aware of the truth or the baseness of the tale.
It is true, and a month thereafter was she returned to me. Her suicide came some months after the birth of her son Martin. What have you to say to that, Prince Random?
Nothing. One, nothing long you mind you, one long you Bernice Lee Pied of Mount Farm, the night Pied of Lime.
When Martin came of age, because he was of the blood of Amber, he determined to walk the pattern. He is the only one of my people to have succeeded. Thereafter he walked in shadow, and I have not seen him since. What have you to say to that, Lord Random?
Nothing. One, nothing long you mind you, one long you Bernice Lee Pied of Mount Farm, the night Pied of Lime.
Therefore, I will punish thee. You shall marry the woman of my choice and remain with her in my realm for a year's time, or you will forfeit your life. What say you to that, Random?
Random said nothing, but he nodded abruptly. She stuck her scepter upon the arm of her turquoise throne.
Very well, so be it.
And so it was. We repaired to the chambers she had granted us, there to refresh ourselves. Subsequently, she appeared at the door of my own. Hail, Moir.
Lord Corwin of Amber, often have I wished to meet thee.
And I thee.
Your exploits are legend.
Thank you, but I barely recall the high points.
May I enter here?
Certainly. She moved into the well-appointed suite she had granted me. She seated herself upon the edge of the orange couch.
When would you like to essay the pattern?
As soon as possible. She considered this, then said.
Where have you been among shadows?
Very far from here, in a place that I learned so loved.
It is strange that a Lord of Amber should have this capacity.
What capacity?
To love.
Perhaps they chose the wrong word.
I doubt it, for the ballads of Corwin do touch upon the strings of the heart.
The lady is kind.
But not wrong.
I'll give you a ballad one day.
What did you do when you dwelled in shadow?
It occurs to me that I was a professional soldier, madam. I fought for whoever would pay me. Also, I composed the words and music to many popular songs.
Both these things occur to me as logical and natural.
Pray tell me, what of my brother Random?
He will marry with a girl among my subjects who is named Vial. She is blind and has no wooers among our kind.
Are you certain that you do the best thing for her?
She will obtain good status in this manner, though he depart after a year and never return. For whatever else may be said of him, he is a prince of Amber.
What if she comes to love him?
Could anyone really do this thing?
In my way, I love him as a brother.
Then this is the first time a son of Amber has ever said such a thing, and I attribute it to your poetic temperament.
Whatever, be very sure that it is the best thing for the girl.
I have considered it. and I am certain she will recover from whatever pain he inflicts, and after his departure she will be a great lady of my court.
So may it be. I looked away, feeling a sadness come over me. For the girl, of course, what may I say to you? Perhaps you do a good thing. I hope so. And I took her hand and kissed it.
You, Lord Corwin, are the only prince of Amber I might support, save possibly for Benedict. He is gone these 12 years and 10, however, and Lear knows where his bones may lie. Pity.
I did not know this. My memory is so screwed up. Please bear with me. I shall miss Benedict, and he be dead. He was my master of arms and taught me of all weapons, but he was gentle. As are you, Corwin? She took my band and drew me toward her. No, not really. I seated myself on the couch at her side.
We've much time till we dine.
Then she leaned against me with the front of her shoulder, which was soft. When do we eat?
Whenever I declare it.
She faced me more fully. So I drew her upon me and found the catch to the buckle which covered the softness of her belly. There was more softness beneath, and her hair was green. Upon the couch, I gave her her ballad. Her lips replied without words. After we had eaten, and I had learned the trick of eating underwater, which I might detail later on if circumstances really warrant, we rose from our places within the marble high hall, decorated with nets and ropes of red and brown, and we made our way back along a narrow corridor and down, down beneath the floor of the sea itself. First by means of a spiral staircase that screwed its way through absolute darkness and glowed. After about 20 paces, my brother said,
"Screw,"
stepped off the staircase and began swimming downward alongside it.
"It is faster that way."
"And it is a long way down,"
said Deirdre, knowing the distance of the one in amber. So we all stepped off and swam downward through darkness beside the glowing, twisting thing. It took perhaps 10 minutes to reach the bottom, but when our feet touched the floor, we stood, with no tendency to drift. There was light about us then, from a few feeble flames set within niches in the wall. Why is this part of the ocean, within the double of amber, so different from waters elsewhere?
"Because that is the way it is."
Which irritated me. We were in an enormous cavern, and tunnels shot off from it in all directions. We moved toward one. After walking along it for an awfully long while, we began to encounter side passages, some of which had doors or grills before them, and some of which did not. At the seventh of these we stopped. There was a huge gray door of some slate-like substance, bound in metal, towering to twice my height. I remembered something about the size of Tritons as I regarded that doorway. Then Moyer smiled, just at me, and produced a large key from a ring upon her belt and set it within the lock. She couldn't turn it, though. Perhaps the thing had been unused for too long. Random growled, and his hand shot forward, knocking hers aside. He seized the key in his right hand and twisted. There came a click. Then he pushed the door open with his foot, and we stared within. In a room the size of a ballroom, the pattern was laid. The floor was black and looked smooth as glass. And on the floor was the pattern. It shimmered like the cold fire that it was, quivered, made the whole room seem somehow unsubstantial. It was an elaborate tracery of bright power composed mainly of curves, though there were a few straight lines near its middle. It reminded me of a fantastically intricate, life-scale version of one of those maze things you do with a pencil, or ballpoint as the case may be, to get you into or out of something. Like, I could almost see the words, "start here," somewhere way to the back. It was perhaps 100 yards across at its narrow middle and maybe 150 long. It made bells ring within my head. And then came the throbbing. My mind recoiled from the touch of it. But if I were a prince of amber, then somewhere within my blood, my nervous system, my genes, this pattern was recorded somehow so that I would respond properly, so that I could walk the bloody thing. I sure wish I could have a cigarette. The girls giggled, though rather a little too rapidly, and perhaps with a bit of a twist of the treble control.
"It's an ordeal, but it's not impossible, or we wouldn't be here. Take it very slow and don't let yourself heed distracted. Don't be alarmed by the shower of spards that will rise with each step. They can't hurt you. You'll feel a mild current passing through you the whole time, and after a while you'll start feeling high. But keep concentrating and don't forget. Keep walking. Don't stop whatever you do, and don't stray from the path, or it'll probably kill you."
As he spoke, we walked. We walked close to the right-hand wall and rounded the pattern, heading toward its far end. The girls trailed behind us. I whispered to him, I tried to talk her out of this thing she's planned for you. No luck.
I figured you would. Don't worry about it. I can do a year standing on my head, and they might even let me go sooner, if I'm obnoxious enough.
The girl she has lined up for you is named Vial. She's blind.
Great, great joke.
Remember that regency we spoke of?
Yeah.
Be kind to her then. Stay the full year, and I will be generous. Nothing. Then he squeezed my arm.
Friend of yours, huh? What's she like?
Is it a deal?
It's a deal.
Then we stood at the place where the pattern began, near to the corner of the room. I moved forward and regarded the line of inlaid fires that started near to the spot where I had placed my right foot. The pattern constituted the only illumination within the room. The waters were chill about me. I strode forward, setting my left foot upon the path. It was outlined by blue-white sparks. Then I set my right foot upon it, and I felt the current Random had mentioned. I took another step. There was a crackle, and I felt my hair beginning to rise. I took another step. Then the thing began to curve, abruptly, back upon itself. I took 10 more paces, and a certain resistance seemed to arise. It was as if a black barrier had grown up before me, of some substance which pushed back upon me with each effort that I made to pass forward. I fought it. It was the first veil, I suddenly knew. To get beyond it would be an achievement, a good sign, showing that I was indeed part of the pattern. Each raising and lowering of my foot suddenly required a terrible effort, and sparks shot forth from my hair. I concentrated on the fiery line. I walked it, breathing beefily. Suddenly the pressure was eased. The veil had parted before me, as abruptly as it had occurred. I had passed beyond it and acquired something. I had gained a piece of myself. I saw the paper skins and the knobby, stick-like bones of the dead of Auschwitz. I had been present at Nuremberg, I knew. I heard the voice of Stephen Spender reciting Vienna, and I saw Mother Courage cross the stage on the night of a Brecht premiere. I saw the rockets leap up from the stained hard places, Peenemünde, Vandenberg, Kennedy, Kaiserslautern, and Kazakhstan, and I touched with my hands the wall of China. We were drinking beer and wine, and Shakespeare said he was drunk and went off to puke. I entered the green forests of the Western Reserve and took 3 scalps one day. I hummed a tune as we marched along and it caught on. It became Au Prés de ma Blonde. I remembered. My life within the shadow place its inhabitants had called the earth. 3 more steps, and I held a bloody blade and saw 3 dead men and my horse, on which I had fled the revolution in France. And more, so much more. Back to, I took another step. Back to, the dead. They were all about me. There was a horrible stink, the smell of decaying flesh, and I heard the howls of a dog who was being beaten to death. Billows of black smoke filled the sky, and an icy wind swept around me, bearing a few small drops of rain. My throat was parched, and my hands shook, and my head was on fire. I staggered alone, seeing everything through the haze of the fever that burned me. The gutters were filled with garbage and dead cats and the emptyings of chamber pots. With a rattle and the ringing of a bell, the death wagon thundered by, splashing me with mud and cold water. How long I wandered, I do not know, before a woman seized my arm and I saw a death's head ring upon her finger. She led me to her rooms, but discovered there that I had no money and was incoherent. A look of fear crossed her pained face, erasing the smile on her bright lips, and she fled and I collapsed upon her bed. Later again. How much later, I do not know, a big man, the girl's black Davy, came and slapped me across the face and dragged me to my feet. I seized his right biceps and hung on. He half carried, half pulled me toward the door. When I realized that he was going to cast me out into the cold, I tightened my grip to protest it. I squeezed with all my remaining strength, mumbling half coherent pleas. Then, through sweat and tear-filled eyes, I saw his face break open and heard a scream come forth from between his stained teeth. The bone in his arm had broken where I'd squeezed it. He pushed me away with his left hand and fell to his knees, weeping. I sat upon the floor and my head cleared for a moment. I am staying here until I feel better. Get out. If you come back, I'll kill you.
You've got the plague. They'll come for your bones tomorrow.
He spat then, got to his feet, and staggered out. I made it to the door and barred it. Then I crawled back to the bed and slept. If they came for my bones the next day, they were disappointed. For, perhaps 10 hours later, in the middle of the night, I awoke in a cold sweat and realized my fever had broken. I was weak but rational once more. I realized I had lived through the plague. I took a man's cloak I found in the wardrobe and took some money I found in a drawer. Then I went forth into London and the night, in a year of the plague, looking for something. I had no recollection of who I was or what I was doing there. That was how it had started. I was well into the pattern now, and the sparks flashed continually about my feet, reaching to the height of my knees. I no longer knew which direction I faced or where Random and Deirdre and Maura stood. The current swept through me and it seemed my eyeballs were vibrating. Then came a pins and needy feeling in my cheeks and a coldness on the back of my neck. I clenched my teeth to keep them from chattering. The auto accident had not given me my amnesia. I had been without full memory since the reign of Elizabeth I. Flora must have concluded that the recent accident had restored me. She had known of my condition. I was suddenly struck by the thought that she was on that shadow earth mainly to keep tabs on me, since the 16th century. Then? That I couldn't say. I'd find out, though. I took 6 more rapid steps, reaching the end of an arc and coming to the beginning place of a straight line. I set my foot upon it, and with each step that I took, another barrier began to rise against me. It was the second veil. There was a right angle turn, then another, then another. I was a prince of amber. It was true. There had been 15 brothers and 6 were dead. There had been 8 sisters and 2 were dead, possibly 4. We had spent much of our time in wandering in shadow or in our own universes. It is an academic, though valid philosophical question, as to whether one with power over shadow could create his own universe. Whatever the ultimate answer, from a practical point we could. Another curve began, and it was as though I were walking in glue as I moved slowly along it. 1, 2, 3, 4, I raised my fiery boots and let them down again. My head throbbed and my heart felt as though it were fibrillating to pieces. Amber. The going was suddenly easy once more as I remembered Amber. Amber was the greatest city which had ever existed or ever would exist. Amber had always been and always would be in every other city, everywhere. Every other city that existed was but a reflection of a shadow of some phase of Amber. Amber, 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 I remember thee. I shall never forget thee again. I guess, deep inside me, I never really did. Through all those centuries I wandered the shadow earth. For often at night my drearns were troubled by images of thy green and golden spires and thy sweeping terraces. I remember thy wide promenades and the decks of flowers, golden and red. I recall the sweetness of thy airs and the temples, palaces, and pleasantanest contained, will always contain, amber, immortal city from which every other city has taken its shape. I cannot forget thee, even now, nor forget that day on the pattern of Reba when I remembered thee within thy reflected walls, fresh from a meal after starvation and the loving of more, but nothing could compare with the pleasure and the love of remembering thee. And even now, as I stand contemplating the courts of tales, tell the cave that thou look 10 paces, then a swirling filigree of fire confronted me. I essayed it, my sweat vanishing into the waters as fast as it sprang forth. It was tricky, so devilish tricky, and it seemed that the waters of the room suddenly moved in great currents which threatened to sweep me from the pattern. I struggled on, resisting them. Instinctively, I knew that to leave the pattern before I'd completed it would mean my death. I dared not raise my eyes from the places of light that lay before me. To see how far I had come, how far I had yet to go, the currents subsided, and more of my memories returned, memories of my life as a prince of amber. No, they are not yours for the asking. They are mine, some vicious and cruel. Others, perhaps noble memories going back to my childhood in the great palace of amber, with the green banner of my father Oberon flaring above it, white unicorn rampant, facing to the dexter. Random had made it through the pattern. Even Deirdre had made it. Therefore I, Corwin, would make it, no matter what the resistance. I emerged from the filigree and marched along the grand curve. The forces that shaped the universe fell upon me and beat me into their image. I had an advantage over any other person who attempted the walk, however. I knew that I had done it before, so I knew that I could do it. This helped me against the unnatural fears which rose like black clouds and were gone again, only to return, their strength redoubled. I walked the pattern, and I remembered all. I remembered all the days before my centuries on the shadow earth. And I remembered other places of shadow, many of them special and dear to me, and one which I loved above all, save for Amber. I walked three more curves, a straight line and a series of sharp arcs, and I held within me once again a consciousness of the things which I had never really lost. Mine was the power over shadows. 10 arcs which left me dizzy, another short arc, a straight line, and the final veil. It was agony to move. Everything tried to beat me aside. The waters were cold, then boiling. It seemed that they constantly pushed against me. I struggled, putting one foot before the other. The sparks reached as high as my waist at this point, then my breast, my shoulders. They were into my eyes. They were all about me. I could barely see the pattern itself. Then a short arc, ending in blackness. 1, 2. And to take the last step was like trying to push through a concrete wall. I did it. Then I turned slowly and looked back over the course I had come. I would not permit myself the luxury of sagging to my knees. I was a prince of amber, and by God, nothing could humble me in the presence of my peers. Not even the pattern. I waved jauntily in what I thought to be the right direction. Whether or not I could be made out very clearly was another matter. Then I stood there a moment and thought. I knew the power of the pattern now. Going back along it would be no trick at all. But why bother? I lacked my deck of cards, but the power of the pattern could serve me just as well. They were waiting for me, my brother and sister, and Moyer, with her thighs like marble pillars. Deirdre could take care of herself from here on out after all. We'd saved her life. I didn't feel obligated to go on protecting her on a day-by-day basis. Random was stuck in Reba for a year, unless he had guts enough to leap forward and take the pattern to the still center of power and perhaps escape. And as for Moyer, it had been nice knowing her. And maybe I'd see her again someday, and like that. I closed my eyes and bowed my head. Before I did so, though, I saw a fleeting shadow. Random. Trying it. Whatever. He wouldn't know where I was headed. No one would. I opened my eyes and I stood in the middle of the same pattern in reverse. I was cold, and I was damn tired. But I was in amber in the real room, of which the one I had departed was but an image. From the pattern, I could transfer myself to any point I wished within amber. Getting back would be a problem, however. So I stood there and dripped and considered. If Eric had taken the royal suite, then I might find him there. Or perhaps in the throne room. But then, I'd have to make my own way back to the place of power. I'd have to walk the pattern again, in order to reach the escape point. I transferred myself to a hiding place I knew of within the palace. It was a windowless cubicle into which some light trickled from observation slits high overhead. I bolted its one sliding panel from the inside, dusted off a wooden bench set beside the wall, spread my cloak upon it, and stretched out for a nap. If anyone came groping his way down from above, I'd hear him long before he reached me. I slept. After a while, I awakened. So I arose, dusted off my cloak, and donned it once more. Then I began to negotiate the series of pegs which laddered their way up into the palace. I knew where it was, the third floor, by the markings on the walls. I swung myself over to a small landing and searched for the peephole. I found it and gazed through. Nothing. The library was empty. So I slid back the panel and entered. Within, I was stricken by the multitudes of books. They always do that to me. I considered everything, including the display cases, and finally moved toward the place where a crystal case contained everything that led up to a family banquet private joke. It held 4 decks of the family cards, and I sought about for a means of obtaining one without setting off an alarm which might keep me from using it. After maybe 10 minutes, I succeeded in gimmicking the proper case. It was tricky. Then, pack in hands, I found a comfortable seat for the consideration thereof. The cards were just like Flora's, and they held us all under glass, and were cold to the touch. Now, too, I knew why. So I shuffled and spread them all out before me, in the proper manner. Then I read them, and I saw that bad things were in store for the entire family. And I gathered them all together then, save for one. It was the card depicting my brother Blaze. I replaced the others in their case and tucked it into my belt. Then I considered Blaze. At about that time, there came a scratching in the lock of the great door to the library. What could I do? I loosened my blade in its scabbard and waited. I ducked low behind the desk, though. Peering out, I saw that it was a guy named Dick who had obviously come to clean the place as he set out emptying the ashtrays and waste baskets and dusting the shelves. Since it would be demeaning to be discovered, I exposed myself. Hello, Dick. Remember me. He turned three kinds of pale, half-bolted, and said,
Of course, Lord. How can I forget?
I suppose it would be possible, after all this time.
Never, Lord Corwin.
I suppose I'm here without official sanction and engaged in a bit of illicit research. But if Eric doesn't like it when you tell him that you saw me, please explain that I was simply exercising my rights, and he will be seeing me personally soon.
Lil do that, my lord.
Come sit with me a moment, friend Dick, and I'll tell you more. And he did. So I did. There was a time when I was considered gone for good and abandoned forever. Since I still live, however, and since I maintain all my faculties, I fear that I must dispute Eric's claim to the throne of Amber. Though it's not a thing to be settled simply, as he is not the firstborn, nor do I feel he would enjoy popular support if another were in sight. For these, among other reasons, most of them personal, I am about to oppose him. I have not yet decided how nor upon what grounds, but by God, he deserves opposition. Tell him that, if he wishes to seek me. Tell him that I dwell among shadows, but different ones than before. He may know what I mean by that. I will not be easily destroyed, for I will guard myself at least as well as he does here. I will oppose him from hell to eternity, and I will not cease until one of us is dead. What say you to this, old retainer? And he took my hand and kissed it.
Hail to thee, Corwin, Lord of Amber.
There was a tear in his eye. Then the door cracked a crack behind him and swung open. Eric entered. Hello, rising and putting a most obnoxious twang to my voice. I didn't expect to meet with you this early in the game. How go things in Amber? And his eyes were wide with amaze and his voice heavy with that which men call sarcasm. And I can't think of a better word, as he replied.
Well, when it comes to things, Corwin, poorly on other counts, however.
Pity, and how should we put things right?
No way.
And then he glared at Dick, who promptly departed and closed the door behind him. I heard it snick shut. Eric loosened his blade and its scabbard.
You want the throne.
Don't we all?
I guess so. It's true that uneasy lies the head bit. I don't know why we are driven to strive so for this ridiculous position. But you must recall that I've defeated you twice, mercifully granting you your life on a shadow world the last occasion.
It wasn't that merciful. You know where you left me? To die of the plague? The first time, as I remember, it was pretty much a draw.
Then it is between the two of us now, Corwin. I am your elder and your better. If you wish to try me armed, I find myself suitably attired. Slay me, and the throne will probably be yours. Try it. I don't think you can succeed, however. And I'd like to quit your claim right now, so come at me. Let's see what you learned on the Shadow Earth.
And his blade was in his hand and mine in mine. I moved around the desk. What an enormous chutzpah you possess. What makes you better than the rest of us and more fit to rule?
The fact that I was able to occupy the throne, try and take it.
And I did. I tried a head cut which he parried, and I parried his riposte to my heart and cut at his wrist. He parried this and kicked a small stool between us. I set it aside, hopefully in the direction of his face, with my right toe, but it missed and he had at me again. I parried his attack and he mine. Then I lunged, was parried, was attacked, and parried again myself. I tried a very fancy attack I'd learned in France, which involved a beat, a feint in quart, a feint in sixte, and the lunge veering off into an attack on his wrist. I nicked him, and the blood flowed.
Oh, damnable brother, report has it. Random accompanies thee.
This is true. More than one of us are assembled against you. And he lunged then, and beat me back. And I felt suddenly that for all my work, he was still my master. He was perhaps one of the greatest swordsmen I had ever faced. I suddenly had the feeling that I couldn't take him, and I parried like mad and retreated in the same fashion as he beat me back, step by step. We both had centuries under the greatest masters of the blade in business. The greatest alive, I knew, was Brother Benedict, and he wasn't around to help, one way or the other. So I snatched things off the desk with my left hand and threw them at Eric. But he dodged everything and came on strong, and I circled to his left and all like that, but I couldn't draw the point of his blade from my left eye. And I was afraid. The man was magnificent. If I didn't hate him so, I would have applauded his performance. I kept backing away, and the fear and the knowledge came upon me. I knew I still couldn't take him. He was a better man than I was when it came to the blade. I cursed this, but I couldn't get around it. I tried three more elaborate attacks and was defeated on each occasion. He parried me and made me retreat before his own attacks. Now, don't get the wrong idea. I'm damn good. It's just that he seemed better. Then there were some alarms and excuses in the hall outside. Eric's retainers were coming, and if he didn't kill me before they arrived, then I was confident that they'd do the job, probably with a bolt from a crossbow. There was blood dripping from his right wrist. His hand was still steady. But I had the feeling then that under other circumstances, by fighting a defensive fight, I just might be able to wear him down with that wrist injury going against him, and perhaps I could get through his guard at the proper moment when he began to slow. I cursed softly.
You're a fool to have come here.
He didn't realize what I was doing until it was too late. I'd been retreating until the door was at my back. It was risky, leaving myself with no room for retreat. But it was better than sure death. With my left hand, I managed to drop the bar. It was a big, heavy door, and they'd have to knock it down now to get in. That gave me a few more minutes. It also gave me a shoulder wound, from an attack I could only partly parry as I dropped the bar. But it was my left shoulder. My sword arm remained intact. I smiled, to put up a good front. Perhaps you were a fool. To enter here, you're slowing, you know. I tried a hard, fast, vicious attack. He parried it, but he fell back two paces in doing so. That wound's getting to you, your arm's weakening. You can feel the strength leaving it.
Shut up.
I realized I'd gotten through to him. This increased my chances by several percent, I decided. And I pressed him as hard as I could, realizing I couldn't keep that pace up very long. But Eric didn't realize it. I'd planted the seeds of fear, and he fell back before my sudden onslaught. There was a banging on the door, but I didn't have to worry about that for a while anyway. I'm going to take you, Eric. I'm tougher than I used to be. And you've had it, brother. I saw the fear begin in his eyes, and it spread over his face, and his style shifted to follow suit. He began fighting a completely defensive battle, backing away from my attack. I'm sure he wasn't faking either. I felt I had bluffed him, for he had always been better than I. But what if it had been partly psychological on my part, too? What if I had almost beaten myself with this attitude, which Eric had helped to foster? What if I had bluffed myself all along? Maybe I was as good. With a strange sense of confidence, I tried the same attack I had used before, and I scored, leaving another trail of red on his forearm. That was rather stupid. Eric, to fall for the same trick twice? He backed around a wide chair. We fought across it for a time. The banging on the door stopped. And the voices which had been shouting inquiries through it fell silent.
They've gone for axes. They'll be in here in no time.
I wouldn't drop my smile. I held it and said, It'll take a few minutes, which is more time than I'll need to finish this. You can hardly keep your guard now, and the blood keeps running, look at it.
Shut up.
By the time they get through, there will be only one prince in amber, and it won't be you. Then, with his left arm, he swept a row of books from a shelf, and they struck me and fell about me. He didn't seize the opportunity to attack, however. He dashed across the room, picking up a small chair, which he held in his left hand. He wedged himself into a corner and held the chair and his blade before him. There were rapid footsteps in the hall outside, and then axes began to ring upon the door.
Come on, try and take me now.
You're scared. He laughed.
Academic, you can't take me before that door falls, and then it will be all over for you.
I had to agree. He could hold off my blade with that setup, at least for quite a few minutes. I crossed the room quickly to the opposite wall. With my left hand, I opened the panel through which I had entered. Okay, it looks like you're going to live. For a time, you're lucky. Next time we meet, there won't be anyone to help you. He spat and called me a few traditional vile names, even putting down the chair to add an obscene gesture as I ducked through the panel and closed it behind me. There came a thunk, and 8 inches of steel gleamed on my side of the panel as I was fastening it. He had thrown his blade. Risky if I chose to return, but he knew I wouldn't, for the door sounded about ready to fall. I descended the pegs as rapidly as I could, to the place where I had slept earlier. As I did, I considered my increased skill with the blade. At first, in the battle, I had been awed by the man who had beaten me before. Now, though, I wondered. Perhaps those centuries on the Shadow Earth were not a waste. Maybe I had actually gotten better during that time. Now I felt that I might be Eric's equal with the weapon. This made me feel good. If we met again, as I was sure we would, and there was no outside interference, who knew? I would court the chance, however. Today's encounter had scared him. I was certain that might serve to slow his hand, to cause the necessary hesitation on the next occasion. I let go and dropped the final 15 feet, bending my knees as I landed. I was the proverbial 5 minutes ahead of the posses, but I was sure I could take advantage of it and escape, for I had the cards in my belt. I drew the card that was Blaze and stared at it. My shoulder hurt, but I forgot it as the coldness came upon me. There were two ways to depart directly from Amber into Shadow. One was the pattern, seldom used for this purpose. Another was the trumps, if you could trust a brother. I considered Blaze. I could almost trust him. He was my brother, but he was in trouble and could use my help. I stared at him, flame-crowned, dressed all in red and orange, with a sword in his right hand and a glass of wine in his left. The devil danced in his blue eyes, his beard blazed, and the tracery on his blade, I suddenly realized, flared with a portion of the pattern. His rings flashed. He seemed to move. The contact came like an icy wind. The figure on the card seemed life-size now and changed position into whatever stance he presently held. His eyes did not quite focus upon me, and his lips moved.
Was it?
They said, and I heard the words, Corwin. I had some misgivings when I heard about the latter, though I knew I was really me. The former smacked of being a bit unworkable, since the fleet would be too far out to sea to receive any signals from the shore, and the chance of missing the date allowing for mishaps when it came to a body that large was too great, as I saw it, to encourage a whole big lot of faith in his general plan. He held forth his left hand, which no longer bore the goblet.
Then come to me if you would.
I reached forth and our fingers met. I took a step. I was still holding the card in my left hand, but Blaze and I stood together on a cliff, and there was a chasm to our side and a high fortress to our other side. The sky above us was the color of flame. Hello, Blaze, I said, tucking the card into my belt with the others. Thanks for the assistance. I suddenly felt weak and realized the blood was still flowing from my left shoulder.
You're wounded,
he said, throwing an arm about my shoulders, and I started to nod, but fainted instead. Later that night, I sprawled in a big chair within the fortress and drank whiskey. We smoked and passed the bottle and talked.
So you were actually an Amber?
Yes, that's right.
And you wounded Eric in your duel?
Yes.
Damn, I wish you'd killed him. Well, maybe not. Then you'd have held the throne. I might have a better chance against Eric than I'd have had against you. I don't know. What are your plans?
I decided upon complete honesty. We all want the throne, so there's no reason to lie to one another. I'm not about to try killing you for it. That would be foolish. But on the other hand, I'm not about to renounce my claim because I'm enjoying your hospitality. Random would like it, but he's pretty much out of the picture. No one has beard from Benedict for some time now. Gerard and Kane seem to be supporting Eric rather than promoting their own claims. The same goes for Julian. That leaves Bran and our sisters. I don't know what the hell Bran is up to these days, but I do know that Deirdre is without power, unless she and Luella can raise something in Reba, and Flora is Eric's creature. I don't know what Fiona is up to.
And so that leaves us?
Blaze, pouring us each another drink.
Yes, you're right. I don't know what's going on in everyone's head right now, but I can assess our relative strengths, and I think I'm in the best position. You made a wise choice in coming to me. Support me, and I'll give you a regency.
Bless your heart. We'll see. We sipped our whiskeys.
What else is there to do?
I realized that the question was important. I might raise an army of my own to lay siege to Amber.
Where among shadows lies your army?
That, of course, is my affair. I don't think I'd oppose you. When it comes to monarchs, I'd like to see either you, me, Gerard, or Benedict, if he still lives upon the throne.
Preferably you, of course.
Of course.
Then we understand one another. So I think we can work together for the time being.
And I, else I would not have delivered myself into your hands. He smiled within his herd.
You needed someone, and I was the lesser evil.
True.
I wish Benedict were Bree. I wish Gerard had not sold out.
Wish in one hand, and do something else in the other, and squeeze them both, and see which comes true.
Well taken.
We smoked a while in silence.
How far can I trust you?
As far as I can trust to a pert.
Then let's make a deal. Frankly, I had thought you dead for many years. I hadn't foreseen your showing up at a crucial time and pressing your own claim. But you're here, and that's that. Let's form an alliance, combine our forces, and lay siege to Amber. Whichever of us lives through it winds up on top. If we both do, well, hey, we can always fight a duel.
I thought about it. It sounded like the best deal I'd get anywhere. I'd like to sleep on it. Tell you in the morning, okay?
Okay.
We finished our drinks then and fell to reminiscing. My shoulder throbbed a bit, but the whiskey helped, and the salve which Blaze had supplied. After a time, we were almost maudlin. It is strange, I guess, to have kin and to be without kinship, for as long as our lives had led us along our separate paths. Lord, we talked the moon out of the heavens before either of us grew tired. Then he clacked me upon my good shoulder and told me that he was beginning to feel his load, and that a servant would be by in the morning to bring my breakfast. I nodded, we embraced, and he retired. Then I moved to the window, and from that vantage I could see down far into the chasm. The campfires below burned like stars. There were thousands of them. I could tell that Blaze had assembled a mighty force, and I was envious. But, on the other hand, it was a good thing. If anyone could take Eric, it was probably Blaze. He wouldn't. He a bad thing in Amber, it was just that I preferred me. Then I watched a while longer, and I saw that strange shapes moved among the lights. I wondered then as to the nature of his army. Whatever. It was more than I possessed. I made my way back to the table and poured me a final drink. Before I quaffed it, however, I lighted a taper. In its light, I withdrew the pack of cards I had stolen. I spread them before me, and I came across the one depicting Eric. I laid it in sick center of the table and put the rest away. After a time, it came to life. And I saw Eric in his sleeping garments, and I heard the words,
"Who is it?"
His arm was bound. "Me, Corwin. How are you?" He cursed then. This was a dangerous game, and maybe the whiskey had contributed to it. But I continued, "I just felt like telling you that all goes well with me. I also wanted to advise you that you were right when you spoke of the uneasy head. You won't be wearing it long, though. So cheerio, brother. The day I come again to Amber is the day you die. Just thought I'd tell you, since that day is not too far off."
"Come ahead, and I'll not want for grace in the matter of your passing."
His eyes focused on me then, and we were close. I thumbed my nose at him and passed my palm over the card. It was like hanging up a telephone. And I shuffled Eric in with all the rest. I wondered, though, as I approached sleep, concerning those troops of Blaze which occupied the defile below, and I thought upon Eric's defenses. It would not be easy.